buttonhole are deeply. When the office of the inspecting judge is reporting about this incident in prison, and there's not an improvement. You know, the law is very clear that when an inmate is terminally ill, that the Department of Correctional Services, with doctor's report and one other opinion, must take action against them. But now we don't see anything. Even your last report, 2004-2005, 1,500 people died in prison. Now, Mr. Munting, we have invited Mr. Munting, we have invited the Human Rights Commission to come and share with us what their experience is as organizations, but specifically the Human Rights Commission. What is there that the Human Rights Commission sees can be done to remedy this problem? Now, with on our agenda, we have put the Human Rights Commission first, but Mr. Munting has asked, because Mr. Munting is have said that he must catch a plane at 12. So, with other words, Mr. Munting must at least leave here at 11:15. And he has asked us to put him first, and then the Human Rights Commission second. So, Mr. Munting, we are giving you the platform, but you must also understand we are going to ask questions. Don't go on and on and on and on. We must have questions for clarification, and then we will have Mr. Denzel to brief us from the Human Rights Commission. Over to you, sir.
Mr.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bloom. Just to be correct, I've got it by 11:45 at the latest. But I'll try and be brief and to the point. thank you for the kind words about my involvement with this committee over the years. I think we've had a very good relationship, and I would like to acknowledge the contribution of the committee to Parliament's effective functioning and oversight over each term. This may indeed be the last opportunity for me to address this committee, so thank you very much.
Like all of us.
We're very glad that this issue has finally been taken up by the committee. This issue of medical parole and death in custody is an important issue, and so we are really pleased with that. I would also like to make use of this opportunity just to raise an issue on the side, and that was the reports in the media last week about the severe overcrowding at Mthatha Prison. It is not acceptable. A lot of stakeholders have done a lot of work over the years, especially the Judicial Inspectorate, and yet we see conditions such as those reported. We are 14 years into a democracy. It is not acceptable under any circumstances. My submission will deal, the written submission describes the issue in detail. I'll raise some of the issues as in overview, and I'll just highlight particular issues that I believe are pertinent to the issue. Acknowledging the high number of deaths and low number of releases on medical parole poses fundamentally a humanitarian question. Why are so many people dying inside prison when the legislation provides an accepted mechanism to enable prisoners to die a dignified and consolatory death? regardless of the crimes that were committed and the punishment imposed, a humane society has an obligation to act in a manner that recognizes the dignity of every individual, even the violent criminal. And that should be our guiding principle. The submission will deal with some of the statistics that are available on death in custody, and particularly medical parole. I will touch on the interpretation of the legal provisions, and then make some recommendations for addressing the current problems in the medical parole system, and also make some recommendation on the prevention of deaths in custody. In respect of statistics, as you pointed out, Chair, the Judicial Inspectorate has consistently expressed concern about the high number of deaths and the low number of medical releases, and that's not news. And these statistics are reflected in chart 1 or figure 1 in the written submission. And it is obvious where the death in custody nearly reached 1,700 around about 2004. The highest number of releases, medical parole releases, were a mere 117 in 2003. So there is a vast discrepancy, and these two trends don't even follow each other. We can't even say that the one is proportional or the other. There is no correlation. Figure 2 in the written submission shows a further worrying trend, and that is that 37% of deaths in custody due to natural causes occur within the first 12 months of imprisonment, and 62% occur within the first 3 years of imprisonment. And this is something that the Judicial Inspectorate has also raised in its annual report, in the 2006-07 report. There is little doubt that imprisonment itself can have a severe consequence on a person's health. Individuals may have also contracted certain diseases such as TB, HIV, or developed cancer prior to imprisonment, and the deterioration of their condition is then accelerated by inadequate medical services and poor conditions of imprisonment. What is particularly worrying about this trend is that perfectly manageable conditions such as diabetes, asthma, have now become life-threatening conditions. In managing and preventing deaths in prisons, the period immediately after admission is therefore critical to ensure that health and medical problems are identified in time. In terms of the mortality profile of people who have died, there doesn't appear to be any difference in respect of whether they're sentenced or unsentenced, men or women. They reflect the overall profile of the prison population. What is, however, less clear is the exact causes of death, when this is due to natural causes. We have not seen statistics of this nature from the inspectorate or from the department, and I think this would be helpful in bringing about greater understanding of how to manage these cases. The cause of death has implications for the current debate on medical parole, as different illnesses and the prognosis for recovery may require different responses from the department in respect of medical parole. Accurate information on the cause of death will firstly establish if the department is indeed providing proper care to prisoners suffering from treatable, manageable, or curable conditions. Secondly, it's furthermore necessary to establish the mortality profile and cause of death, if applicable, of prisoners who have been released on medical parole. It is important that our policies and decisions are based on reliable information and not on isolated incidents that are profit as policy anchors. I will now deal with the legislative provisions. I'm quite sure everybody is familiar with Section 79 of the Act. It is written there. I'm not going to repeat it, but that is in essence the clause that of the section that provides for medical parole. It's also important to note that unsentenced prisoners are excluded from this provision. Those prisoners who are terminally ill will have to be dealt with through another mechanism that is possibly under the Criminal Procedure Act, or they have to make an application to court. What we have to bear in mind in terms of medical parole is that it is singular in purpose. It is there to allow the prisoner to die a consolatory and dignified death. Parole and medical parole as they stand now are not there to address the shortcomings of the prison system. And about that we need to be very firm. Unless we change the law, that is what it provides for. What appears to be more problematic is the interpretation of the phrase in section 79, and I quote, in the final phase of any terminal disease or condition, unquote. One may indeed ask, how final is final? Section 79 sets two requirements in respect of the medical practitioner's assessment. Firstly, the diagnosis must indicate that the disease or condition is terminal and that there is thus no chance of recovery. It is inevitable that the patient will die from the diagnosed disease. Secondly, the medical practitioner's prognosis finds that the patient's condition is of such a nature that his or her demise is imminent. It will happen soon. This became a core issue in the case of Stanfield versus the Minister of Correctional Services. And I'll just make a few comments about that case. But incidentally, it is the current acting inspecting judge, Judge Van Sale, who was the judge in this particular matter. And I think one would be able to draw on his expertise on this particular issue. Mr. Stanfield received a six-year prison sentence for tax evasion. Some may remember Mr. Stanfield was a high-profile gangster here on the Cape Flats. He applied to be released on medical parole, but the department denied the application, and thus the case went to the Cape High Court. A driving, but as it would turn out, irrelevant set of factors in the parole board's decision-making was that Mr. Stanfield was not visibly ill, although hospitalized, and that he continued to smoke. It also appears that many of the motivating factors in the department's decision-making, in this case, will be perception, without factual base and opinions without legal merit. And some of those reasons are listed there. They said his life expectancy was between 6 and 12 months. He was still able to feed and dress himself. He was a high-profile prisoner, and the objectives of punishment had not been brought home, and he had not yet served one-third of his sentence. An important issue that emerged from this case was the ability of the department to provide the necessary care to Mr. Stanfield, and the court concluded that it was not within the ability of the department at that time. It may have changed subsequently. The court also made reference to life expectancy and was not pleased with the views of the department's official when motivating the denial of the application. And I quote from the judgment, the suggestion by the third respondent that the applicant's life expectancy was not so short that further incarceration would not serve a purpose and that there was no assurance that he would abstain from committing a crime cannot, in my view, constitute a requirement in terms of Section 69 of the old Act. There is no indication of what a short as opposed to a not-so-short life expectancy may be, nor can it be determined when a prisoner is so ill that it would be physically impossible for him to commit a crime. I should imagine that the commission of further crimes would be the last thing on the mind of any prisoner released on parole for medical reasons, particularly when he knows that he only has a few months to live. In the course of the judgment, Judge Van Sale repeatedly returns to the constitutional requirement of respecting the dignity of Mr. Stanfield and regarded the reluctance of the department to allow the application for release on medical parole as an attack on his dignity. And I quote again from the judgment, to insist that he remain incarcerated until he has become visibly debilitated and bedridden can by no stretch of the imagination be regarded as humane treatment in accordance with his inherent dignity. On the contrary, the overriding impression gained from the third respondent's attitude in this regard is that the applicant must lose his dignity before it is recognized and respected. From the above, it is concluded that the test for what is final rests on the promotion and protection of the prisoner's dignity. Under the circumstances of a poor prognosis and imminent death, concerns regarding the administration of criminal justice and punishment become subservient to the right to dignity. The duty to promote and protect the right to dignity should, however, be assessed on a case-by-case basis, looking at the factors directly relevant to this. The written submission deals with a proposed amendment to Section 79. I'm not going to go into that. I think the committee is familiar with the arguments around that, and the proposed amendment was rejected, although there are some lessons to be learned from that. I'll now deal with the issue of achieving consistency. How are these decisions made so that we can promote consistency across all cases and get decisions that are fair? The current procedure is described there, and they are drawn from the current B orders and summarized. It's a fairly, on the face, a fairly simple process. Firstly, a medical report on the prisoner is completed by a medical doctor and it's submitted to the head of center for comment and recommendation and for further submission to the case management committee. The next step is that the case management committee will evaluate the recommendation or the request for release on medical parole and advise the parole board or the area manager on the following issues. The most suitable institution or hospital for aftercare and accommodation, which may also be the family. And there must be a written undertaking of this. Whoever receives the prisoner must give that assurance. The case management committee would then send the recommendation or request per the medical report of the prisoner to the area manager, the court, or the parole board for assessment and decision. There are different authorities who can decide on release. It's an issue I'll come back to later. Just below. Where the authority is set out. Prisoners serving a sentence of less than, and these provisions have now changed slightly in terms of the length of custody. So it is the National Commissioner who, in terms of the amendment bill, will make a decision with regard to prisoners serving a sentence of less than 24 months. If the sentence is less, longer than 24 months, but not life, then it will be the parole board. Life imprisonment will be a decision of the minister. There was a provision under the prior to the amendment that life imprisonment would go to the court of quo. That has been changed now. And then that persons declared as dangerous criminals in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act will still need to go to the court of quo. This was not affected by the amendment. The B orders also list a number of factors that, and I quote, should also be seriously kept in mind when considering a prisoner for placement or release on medical grounds, unquote. There are a number of administrative factors. I only list the substantive factors in the submission. I'm not going to go through that in detail, but I think there are a number of issues there that will need to be interrogated if one is to improve the procedure. So, despite the attempt to simplify the procedure in the Correctional Services Amendment Bill, the fact remains that four distinct institutions have authority over medical parole, and that this authority is essentially derived from the sentence that was imposed on the offender and has little to do with the essence of the issue being decided, namely the medical condition of the prisoner and his or her prognosis. There is indeed the need to simplify this and bring about not only consistency but also prompt decision making. In respect of the parole boards, it's well known that there exist substantial backlogs in respect of parole applications in general. It is, however, not known if these delays are also extend to medical parole applications, and it is therefore submitted that the committee inquires from the department in this regard. The submission then deals with a number of recommendations to promote consistency and prompt decision-making. The Act, the position of the Correctional Services Act is clear in describing the purpose of medical parole, namely to ensure that the prisoner who is diagnosed in the final stages of a terminal disease or condition be released to die a consolatory and dignified death. The Act does not subject such releases conditional to security concerns or questions about whether the purpose of punishment has been achieved. The central duty placed on the department is to ensure the dignity of prisoners in the final stages of his or her life. In view of this, it is recommended that the department critically examines and revises where necessary its policies and procedures to give effect to this obligation. It is furthermore recommended that the staff of the department and the parole board chairpersons be trained accordingly to give effect to this duty. Secondly, and emanating from the fact that we really don't have enough, especially statistical information, to understand this issue properly, we recommend that the committee request the department to provide it with the necessary quantitative and qualitative information pertaining to trends in deaths of prisoners and medical parole, and the written submission lists a number of issues there which we regard as this should be the absolute minimum information that should be requested from the department. In the above, it was noted that there are four distinct institutions with the authority to release people on medical parole. This is, however, an oversimplification. The parole board is not one institution. There are 52 of them. Similarly, heads of centers, there's not one, but there are 237. So, in essence, this structure is too large and complicated and creates too many variables to ensure consistency in decision-making in general, but more specifically in respect of medical parole. It is therefore recommended that the committee inquires from the department as to the possible restructuring of the parole board system in order to create a structure that would alleviate the current problems. From our investigations, it's also apparent that there are considerable delays in the decision-making process. One important reason for these delays is that prisoners who are sick are not identified by the medical staff in time so that the process of investigation and gathering of information can start. It is therefore recommended that the committee request specific proposals from the department on how the current procedure can be streamlined and decision-making expedited. Section 76 of the Act established the Correctional Services and Parole Review Board. And Section 75 stipulates that a decision of the parole board is final unless the minister or the commissioner or the inspecting judge, following the amendment bill, places the decision before the parole review board for consideration. It's our assessment that the parole review board is not there to function as an appeals chamber for the parole boards. It is a part-time structure, staffed, if one can call it that, by people either ex officio or as volunteers. It is not a fully functioning office. And it's more likely that the Parole Review Board was conceptualized as a body that would develop guidelines for the parole boards based on actual cases that are referred to it. In view of the above, it is recommended that the Parole Review Board assumes this function assertively and provide the necessary guidance on medical parole. The Correctional Services Amendment Bill empowers the inspecting judge to refer parole matters to the Parole Review Board, and it is therefore submitted that the Office of the Inspecting Judge be requested to actively seek out cases involving medical parole and submit these to the Parole Review Board for consideration. The Correctional Services Amendment Bill also created the incarceration framework. And this still needs to be assessed by Parliament and approved. It is therefore submitted that the committee in its deliberations on the incarceration framework, when it is submitted to by the Department to Parliament, be mindful of the dire need for simplification in the overall parole administration and also reflect on issues pertaining to medical parole. The Act in Section 79 makes provision for the placement under supervision or on parole. It does not specifically state that such a release must be conditional or unconditional. The G337 form, the medical report on prisoner, gives effect to this by specifying that a release may be conditional or unconditional. There is nothing preventing the department to impose any of the conditions listed under Section 52 of the Act, with a few exceptions as provided for in law, when releasing prisoners on parole or medical parole. It is therefore recommended that the department, where the case warrants it, make placements under correctional supervision and on medical parole for medical reasons, conditional to the provisions in Section 52 of the Act. A few remarks about prevention. Ultimately, we need to prevent that death do in fact occur in custody. The first issue is overcrowding. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but the table that you see on page 12 lists the prisons as at the end of June this year who are 200% full or more. It is a large number of prisons with a large number of prisoners in it. Umtata is there. But we are looking at least two prisons, Bizana, not a large number of prisoners, and Umtata, that are over 300% full. This is based on a calculation that it is 3.34 square meters per prisoner. That is the requirement. If we put three people there, it is 3.34 square meters divided by three. It is one square meter per prisoner. This is inhumane. But it also has a severe effect on people's health. And we see that in the chart in figure 2, where we see 37% of deaths occur within the first 12 months of custody. Secondly, thorough medical screenings and health status examinations of admissions must be done as is required by the Correctional Services Act. It is at that stage that we must identify people who have a medical condition, who are on medication, to ensure that they continue to have access to the medication. The problems that the department is experiencing in respect of healthcare services have been noted by the Portfolio Committee previously, as well as the Judicial Inspectorate. Despite these challenges, all efforts must be made to ensure that prisoners have access to adequate healthcare that is based on the principles of primary healthcare being promotive, preventive, curative, and rehabilitative healthcare services. Further, all prisoners who qualify for antiretroviral therapy must receive this therapy. In conclusion, the challenge is therefore to firstly ensure that as many deaths as possible are indeed prevented. Secondly, to remove or amend the administrative and procedural obstacles hindering the efficient and effective management of medical parole. And thirdly, as intangible as they may be, attitudes towards prisoners, especially those who are terminally ill, need to be addressed to ensure that their right to dignity is upheld. I thank you, Chair.
Mr. Munting, thank you very much. This is straight to the point. It's all in our act here. This Parliament wrote exactly what you have presented to us here. But I don't see that these things are being implemented. That's why we are here to come and discuss. But I'm very much happy, Mr. Munting, you went straight to the issues. And you have not went out and look for things. You have pointed to the Act, the Correctional Services Act. Went to the report of the inspecting judge. Thank you very much. I'm going to open to the members for questions for clarification, because Mr. Munting has indicated that he must leave. And if it is earlier than 11:45, it's fine for Mr. Munting to leave. But members, that's the floor. If there is any question from your side, if there's none, it's also fine. Let me open the floor for questions.
Chairperson, not so much a question, but to actually express a word of appreciation for this kind of information. You know, I'm at another level. I'm dealing with cases where people need to be released, and some of them were these kind of medical situations. But what I want to say is that it seems to me we are, okay, we need the information as a committee, but the wrong people are being addressed yesterday. We should actually speak a lot stronger, with much more vocally towards the department and the issues that is actually taking place there. And it seems to me that our department, as many as a time as they appear before us, the progress at the different stages of the life of an inmate does not get the necessary attention in accordance to our constitution and our acts that's in place to see to inmates in the correctional center. I just want to say a word of thanks for this kind of information.
Thank you, Chair, and likewise, thanks for the presentation. I already have two things that I want to perhaps point to. Clearly, as you pointed out, prison overcrowding is at the center of this particular problem because it stretches resources, it creates conditions which are unhygienic, it allows the transfer of diseases. I mean, and then you say all efforts need to be made to ensure that prison overcrowding is reduced and the prison population remains within the capacity of the DCS's infrastructure. What I mean, with respect, there's an awful amount tied up in that one proposition. And I think that, you know, unpacking that would keep us here for a week and a day. But some crisp recommendations maybe about how that particular thing could be dealt with. And secondly, I was intrigued by your suggestions about the Parole Review Board. And clearly, that seems to be the body that should lay down the guidelines for releasing people on medical parole. But yet, it appears from what you say that it's under-resourced and under-capacitated. What, in your view, needs to happen to the Parole Review Board before it can fulfill the function that you think it's necessary to fulfill? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Minting, you know, you raised this issue, and this issue is very much important.
That you yourself have asked this question.
When is a prisoner, you are now sure that this prisoner, when is when? You know, that question, and it's true that we can say that Dennis Bloom now looks fine. But you see, when is when? Nobody will know when. I'm happy that our specialists have come in now. the specialists have come in, medical specialists here have come in. Now, when is when? You see, that is the question. And that's a weakness. You are correct. That's a weakness in the act that we must look into the new people that will come. But for now, it's a question that we must answer. When is when? When can we say, no, this person is on his way and he can't survive? But that is the three questions, Mr. Minting, that you can answer.
Thank you, Mr. Kipida, for your words. In Mr. Self, it is obviously, it is a very complex issue, and we've struggled with prison overcrowding on the one hand for the past 14 years, and there's been some progress, but then in the past 18 months, we've seen that progress, especially in terms of the unsentenced population, was being undone. The unsentenced dropped to just above 40,000. Last time, at the end of December, it was standing at 54,000. It's come down a little bit again. But so it definitely points in the direction of the criminal justice process, where that number seems to fluctuate greatly on an annual basis. And if it is not monitored, it tends to increase. That number just grows and grows and grows. There was a research study recently commissioned by the Open Society Foundation that they looked at three metropolitan courts and the people who were coming through the system. And they found that half of the cases, these are people who are in custody, half of the cases against those unsentenced prisoners are withdrawn or scrapped from the roll. It means that of the 50,000 people currently in custody, half of those cases will be thrown out. They've been in prison without any purpose because there will be no prosecution. So it does point out to who gets into custody. Did the police do a proper investigation before they arrested? How soon does the prosecutor make a decision that here is in fact a case to follow through? Or do they just let this person sit in prison for 3, 4, 5, 6, 12 months and then eventually make a decision to withdraw the case? So if one is to look at immediate means of addressing the issue, my advice would be look there at the unsentenced population. Secondly, I cannot resist the temptation to comment on infrastructure development. If we look at the list of the prisons that are 200% full, we have to compare that list with the list of planned sites for new prisons and see if they indeed correspond. Because from the first list, we know that is where capacity is required. One has to ask the question, is capacity required in Polokwane? Is it in London? Or is it in fact in Mthatha? So I think one needs to be very careful about this particular issue. Thirdly, if the prison population and the growth in it, and especially the unsentenced population, is monitored actively by an institution such as the Judicial Inspectorate, we have seen in the past the numbers have come down. But that takes effort and it takes work. Somebody's got to do it on a continuous basis. In respect of the Parole Review Board, it is not a full-time office. These are members of the National Council. Some of them are there because they fulfill or are in certain positions in government, and then the others are two judges, members of the community, and so on. So I don't think it was ever conceptualized to be a full-time office. However, I think it may in fact be useful to inquire from the department what they can do to provide at least the necessary support to that review board so that it can make the necessary decisions. It's an important function that it must fulfill. It must give guidance to 52 parole boards as well as to the heads of centers. And therefore it needs about 4 times a year. And one really needs to ask, how do they select their cases? How can they be of the most benefit to their constituency? Mr. Bloom, when is when? I don't think we can ask the question as a time-related one, when. I don't think we're going to find the answer there. For me, there are three issues that we need to look at. The first is that the diagnosis must be terminal. The second is a doctor must say it is imminent. This person's demise is imminent. It will happen soon. We will never know how soon it will happen. Not even the doctor will know this. I think doctors are reluctant to say 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, because they are not God and they cannot see into the future. But they can say it's inevitable and it will happen soon. Thirdly, the duty of the department is to protect the dignity of the prisoner. So if we look at those three factors in combination, that should guide decision-making about when to release a person. There are certain things we can control and there are certain things that we can't control. But the department must make sure that those things that can control promote the dignity of the prisoner in his or her final stages. Thank you.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mundin. I think that it's very clear. When a doctor in your prison and in your response, and when a doctor has made his report, Dennis Bloom, who is a politician, can't question that report of that doctor, because I'm not trained as a doctor, and I don't have any right to question it, to say that this is not. But you see, Mr. Mundi, it's also said in your paper that the medical report on prisons, no, it's not that. That two opinions must. The act is saying that he can be released on parole, but other opinions. It's not that you are questioning the integrity of the report of that doctor in the Chukunga, but you want to make sure that it is the case that this person is terminally ill. But you are correct. No one is above the person who have put us here to say that Dennis Bloom is going to live for 100 years or 90 years like Mandela. Anything. But thank you very much, Mr. Mundi. I think I am clear about this. Any other follow-up questions? Mr. Tolo?
Sometimes to also call a doctor in the prison, also talk to them, to ask them a question.
Yeah.
Because we are not a doctor, but at the same time, we know if you see your son or your wife or your husband, whatever you see, this one, anytime something can happen. Now, I think if we also you can call the doctor, like when we call some other stakeholders, I mean, in the prison, also talk to them about this issue. I think that also can help us. I understand that Chairperson would say you can't, as a politician, to ask it because he knows. But also we know, because we see this person, but if anything can happen. And then to ask a question to him or her, also he can help us. I'm not saying, don't believe them, I'm not saying that, but it's very important also to understand. To talk to them because we've got a problem. You know, I remember in the Middle Trip in Eastern Cape, we went there, I don't know which year. You know, in other cells, the overcrowding inside, it was so hot, like hot water, boiling water, and smelling. You know, I was just saying, let me go out. I'm going to get sick. Now, that kind of thing also is a problem. And, another thing, this thing, Chairperson, you know, you remember in Kimberley, where the Chairperson himself, when we take the card, get some other man there, he stayed for release over June, with a 2 or 3 weeks. But at the same time, the management in the center, they didn't know, they didn't see that problem, those kind of problems. Now, you see, some other thing is overcrowding also. We've got a problem. Even themselves, they didn't know. But when the portfolio committee came, they started to know about this mistake. And in the Polokwan also, if I'm not mistaken, Chairman, you correct me. Some other women, she was over with a fight. They say they will kill what her husband was with her son. The son is 10 or 15 years, the mom it was, I don't know, 10 months or 12 months, I'm not thinking. But she was over for the 5 months. But in the center, they didn't see the problem we faced there. But I think that's why sometimes we face so many problems. Another thing, Comrade Chairperson, you remember in KwaZulu-Natal, in Durban, the regional court, within there, I think 2, 3, 4 years back, where the magistrate was telling us, sometimes we get late about the cases, because you'll find the arriving one of Madangas, sometimes they came late in the court. Sometimes you find the police that drunk. They will say like that. They say, I've got a problem. And you find now magistrate, certain day you must go to some other branch you're still going to do a way. Those kind of things also, they cause a problem in prison. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Bishop Dolo. I think that was comment and consent for you, Bishop Dolo. But thank you very much, Bishop, for the input. Mr. Munting, thank you very much. I don't know if Mr. Chukunga is having something special on this paper. Mr. Munting, thank you very much.
May I just have another slide?
Yes, yes, for sure.
I'm just reading from the report on page 4.
Yes.
It's about the situation around the HIV infections and so on.
Yes.
Now, I just want to hear a little bit more from a human rights point of view. A person that goes into prison, whether sentenced or unsentenced, goes in a healthy, clear, not infected, and that person gets infected in prison. What are the kinds of rights that person can fall back on?
How will we know
that person was clear? Yes, I was going to come to the point, Chairperson, and I wrote it down here, that's one of the challenges, that they're not tested when they go in. They're not tested, and to be tested is voluntary.
Yes.
And if you start testing, you are infringing on their rights. And now that big question, hasn't the time arrived that we should actually start testing people when they go in? Because, the way I see it...
Last weekend you were not there.
I'm sorry, but it is like when you send a reincarcerated person, you're sending that person into death, a death sentence or something like that. Maybe if there's no answer today, it's fine. If I should read some notes somewhere, it's
also fine. We'll ask the department that very thing. Next week we will have the department. Yeah, and then you can repeat it. But it's all about us, and then we will
if I'm not taken away, I will be in it.
Not in Zimbabwe.
Thank you, Chair. Just a brief response to that question, Mr. Kipido. I personally, from a human rights perspective, I don't think that is the route to go. We should encourage people to do voluntary counseling and testing. We should do as much around promotive health care and informing prisoners about how to lead a healthy lifestyle, how to avoid HIV infection. I think that is where our duty is. Compulsory testing raises a number of ethical issues, and even if we know somebody is positive or negative, what do we do with that information? He may be infected the next day. So I think one enters a minefield when you go down that route. Secondly, the issue of infection is important. The department recently held a seminar or a workshop on sexual violence inside prisons. We know it's prevalent. And I think one needs to give the department credit that they for the first time acknowledge that this is a problem. But secondly, we need to look at how the Sexual Offences Act can be used to ensure the safety of prisoners, but also how the department can utilize the Sexual Offences Act to respond appropriately when prison rapes are reported to them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mindy. We will also engage the Office of the Inspector. But let's go straight over to the Human Rights Commission on their presentation to the committee. And I hope that all members. Mr. Pantel, Daniel Pantel, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson, and just allow me to give our gratitude to this committee for inviting us once again, and let me also once again just apologize for the absence of the Chairperson. As you know, he is a person that is very, very fond of topics regarding corrections and the concomitant activities. Actually, my name is Denzel Fonseil. I'm a senior researcher at the South African Human Rights Commission, and I'm also in charge of human rights and crime at the Special Commission. Now, Chairperson, when you come and speak about prisoners' rights or prisoners' conditions of imprisonment and so forth, it sometimes becomes very challenging, and it can leave some people with a sense of disquiet as well, in the sense, like, especially given the backdrop of the high levels of crime and violence in our society and what people think should happen to criminals, for instance. And then your human rights people come, and your civil society organizations, and some politicians, others not, and they say, like, oh, the people have these rights, they have that right, and then say, okay, they are coddling criminals, they are doing that, whatever. So it can become a little bit challenging at times. But it is then we are needed the most, I think. And as we know, that President Mandela, when he said that the moral fiber of any society can be measured by the extent to which it treats its prisoners. Richard Etney, for instance, says that our community treats its prisoners reveals a great deal about that community's moral sensibility and its claim to be humane, enlightened, and committed to the rule of law. And more importantly, if you look at the Supreme Court case in the United States of Rhodes versus Chapman, where Chief Justice Powell said that the treatment of prisoners is indicative of a community's maturity. And 14 years into our democracy, I think we all can agree that we are still building up the value base of our Constitution and what it means to us. And we all know that any Bill of Rights and Constitution is not a neutral instrument, that we must give embodiment to that particular document. And this committee and what we're discussing here, this all forms part of building up their constitution. To interpret what those values mean to us, if we say that our constitution is based on the three reciprocal values of human dignity, equality, and freedom, then it's up to us to give body to that particular core value that underlies our constitution. So, Chairperson, once again, thank you for this opportunity for us also to come here and to further build on, to strengthen our constitutional state, so to say. Thank you. Now, as you know, the South African Human Rights Commission has an overarching mandate when it comes to protecting human rights, promoting the protection and the monitoring of human rights. There are other bodies, and I'm sure that this committee has been briefed, like, on numerous occasions, almost like preaching to the choir. And there are people here with a lot more knowledge than the South African Human Rights Commission, the Korea of CFPRI, my Stanford from Judicial Inspectorate of Prisons, people from the Department of Correctional Services, and the members, honorable members of this committee as well, have on numerous occasions things about deaths in prison, medical parole, and so forth. But sometimes it's also good enough, you know, people's strength. And sometimes it's good to let the choir also hear the old message once again. So if I repeat some of the old messages here, please bear with me here today. I will, at the end of my presentation, talk about what the Human Rights Commission is discussing, some of the challenges that we also are facing in dealing with the adjudication or dealing with prisoner rights cases, the cases of people in custody and at places of detention. Now, I'm going to start with the death in prison. Now, it is comical that when the state makes the great decision to deprive a person of his or her liberty, then it just follows that the state automatically assumes the responsibility of providing for the safety of that particular person whose liberty was deprived. Now, for the state to exercise this liberty responsibly, it is incumbent upon the state to make sure one of its biggest KPIs basically would make sure that deaths in prison, and especially unnatural deaths, are kept to an absolute minimum. We are all familiar with the statistics of the Judicial Inspectorate of Prisons and the number of people that have died. And I can say like 80 people also died from natural causes. Now, if you say that the number, look at the number 80 out of, say, a total prison population of 180,000 plus minus, then in and of itself, it doesn't sound alarming. I think we must be honest. If you look at, I mean, I can probably call 80 people in Biavo that have been murdered alone this year. Probably. I can. So 80 numbers of the total prison population and 251 institutions or... It doesn't sound alarming, and it won't. That is why it won't raise these alarm bells. It won't be on the front page of our newspapers, per se. But it's like the crime statistics, chairperson, and honorable members. It is like you can, these numbers means nothing to people and families of those people who have died in prison. And they find very little solace, even if you say that statistically, there's been a decrease. It means nothing to them. It's like the murder. We can brag us down 8%, but it means nothing. It's still 18,000, still lots of people. And if it's my mother that has been murdered, it's still important to me and us as a family. So, I mean, so it is good. Now, the Judicial Inspectorate also pointed out that although the number has went up from 66 to 80, unnatural deaths in prison, that actually, that per 1,000 prisoners, the number actually went down, I think from 8.3% per 1,000 prisoners to 7 deaths per 1,000 prisoners for the period in 2007-2008 financial year. Now, we think that in all fairness, chairperson and honorable members, I think that we can agree that given the nature of incarceration and the challenges that we are facing within our correctional services, it's probably impossible for government to prevent every unnatural death at this particular point in time. Unnatural death in prison will happen. It can happen in the best of institutions, even with best practices in place, with best infrastructure. Unnatural death in prison will happen, as unfortunate as it may sound. But we, despite this conception, chairperson, we must still remember and we must still admit or concede that the state is still morally, if not legally, obliged to keep the number of deaths in prison as low as possible, zero being the ultimate goal. The right to life, as provided for in Section 11 of our Constitution, is one of those rights which we call non-derogable rights, which means that that is a right which it's entirely protected. Like, it cannot be limited by anything, like even in states of emergencies and so forth. Now, our Constitution is made up very clear in terms of the value that it places on the sanctity of life. And that particular value system must be seen to be carried out throughout the executive and throughout governmental departments. Now, as my colleague from the CSPRI has said, that overcrowding seems to be one of the big problems when it comes to death in prison. And I think that we cannot divorce the problem of death in prison from overcrowding. Now, South Africa, as one of has the highest rate of incarceration in Africa and has one of the highest rates of incarceration in the world. In fact, Africa, we incarcerate people at a rate of 337 people per 100,000 people. Compare that to Nigeria, where they only incarcerate their people at a rate of 30 per 100,000 people. So much of what some people think of Nigerians. So as you can see, that it is... If you look at it like that, we can see that we are up there. And we have talked about now about the condition in Masata, a place built of 580 with 1,600 awaiting trial prisoners. If you pull a sentence prisoners worth, it's almost 400% overcrowded. I mean, big problem. Now, compounding the problem, of course, is the fact that I take this information from the annual report of the JI, where they say like there are in the last year 8,356 inmates in our correctional system who were there because they could not avail bail of R1,000 or less. Further, there were 4,443 inmates who were incarcerated because they could not afford bail of less than 500 rand, and 336 people that were in the system for that reporting period because they could not afford bail of less than 200 rand. Now, I mean, like when you look at things this way, I mean, the picture becomes a lot bleaker. Now, I think people here would agree with me that conditions of overcrowding do have an adverse effect on death in prison, and include both death as a result of natural causes as well as unnatural causes. Because we know that overcrowded prisons provide for a very an extremely stressful environment, both for the inmates as well as the personnel of the correctional institution. And so we know that even our best intended rehabilitation program is bound to fail in conditions of overcrowding. So, Chairperson, I think it's safe to assume that a person's chances of losing his or her life is significantly higher in a place or a prison which is heavily overcrowded than, for instance, in a private prison where there, which only holds the exact amount of people for which it was built. Now, it will be interesting what we as the Human Rights Commission know, and I couldn't find any data. Granted, Chairperson, I didn't have a lot of time to research some of these issues. I basically only had yesterday. It will be very, very interesting for us to know how many of the deaths in our prison were among awaiting trial prisoners, just having that particular figure. But the figure that I'm more interested in is that how many deaths occurred among those who we can agree need not have been incarcerated simply because they could not afford bail. I think that is also very, very important. So, as a commission, I mean, from where we are sitting, looking at overcrowding, we would like to urge government to increase its efforts to address the problem of overcrowding and to give serious consideration to the release of all awaiting trial prisoners who are incarcerated solely because they cannot afford meager bail amounts, and those who do not pose a danger to the communities that they are supposed to be released in. Now, we can put a number on the meager part, as I said. Is it R1,000? Is it R800? Is it R700? That's a policy decision that this committee can probably entertain and take further. But as it is, we must agree that there are people that are unnecessarily so, and even like my colleague has pointed out, that how many cases are being dropped because it can't go any further, and people sitting there like spending 9 months, whatever, and running the risk of losing their lives. I mean, we have to minimize, if we want to minimize the death in prison, that is, I agree with my colleague, CPRI, that is a good place to start with our awaiting trial prisoners. Now, what we also would like to have is to appeal for the heads of prisons to make more use of the Section 3A provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act, and for them really to go and petition magistrates to have awaiting trial prisoners released when they think that their physical safety, the physical safety of some human awaiting trial prisoners are being threatened, or their human dignity is being compromised for one level. Some other measures that we as a commission chairperson think may help to prevent unnecessary death in prison would include that an improved inmate classification system to protect inmates who have committed lesser crimes for the more hardened and dangerous inmates. We also would like to encourage the use of pre-bargaining procedures available to accused persons in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, in particular Section 105 thereof, in order to dispense quicker with cases and thereby reducing the amount of awaiting trial prisoners. We would also like to provide adequate training that this commission to consider the Department of Correctional Service to provide adequate training to equip prison officials to deal better with mentally ill prisoners in order for them to identify threatening behavior or deterioration in the mental state of such inmates. And let me just expand a little bit on that. If you have a mental illness and you are in prison, for the warder, if the inmate doesn't do anything and he's calm, it's okay. He isn't wild. Then he's the best inmate you can have. But that's usually if an inmate goes and stands in a corner, a warder is not necessarily empowered or trained enough to realize that this man may be suffering from a very acute type of depression or some form of mental illness. So because they cannot do it, because they only will react or report cases when people go berserk and, make a scene and so forth, and they can't identify some of the other signs that people may have, which may be precursors to that people being suicidal or may go only attack any time and so forth. And if you look at the United States, for instance, it's also sad. If you look even there in their mental institution in terms of the Human Rights Watch report on that particular aspect, their correction officials only receive on every 3.5 hours of training regarding mental illness. So I think that particular aspect of our prison officials receiving adequate training with regard to mental illness and mental condition pertaining to that is also very important. And also, I would just like to give an aggregation also, disaggregation in terms of our statistics, in terms of how many deaths in custody are also because of mental illness or the way mental illness plays a role in such death. But all of these kind of things, Honorable Chairperson, points out to one thing and one thing only, and it's literally the serious need for the overhaul of our criminal justice system. And it cannot be divorced, and the Department of Correctional Service cannot go into this alone. I think that basic principle, we need to accept it. That our court department of justice, our South African police, even our community department of social development, in the role that we can play, the role of the community safety forum, and so forth, addressing this. So correctional services cannot go walk this path alone. And we think that the integrated approach to dealing with a lot of these matters is absolutely, absolutely necessary. On our table, let me move to the issue of medical parole. It was adequately dealt with by the previous speaker. Now, we accept that the issue of medical parole is probably not as clear-cut and as certain as we probably would have hoped for. And once again, when you talk about parole, medical parole or parole, in the ordinary parole for that matter, the question comes up time and again whether or not we should regard parole as a right or privilege. So these debates are always continuing, and it still influences decision making and policy as to how we treat this. Is it a right or is it a privilege? Now, what we can confirm from the outset is that there is no explicit constitutional provision that gives any person a clear right to medical parole. There isn't. Now, it is clear from Section 79 that as now for the granting of medical parole centered around the desire to afford inmates the opportunity to die consolatory or dignified death, and not so much a way to reduce the prison population by releasing inmates who are capable of leading a productive, self-sufficient, and law-abiding life outside of prison. Now, in the United States, prisoners also don't have a constitutional right to parole. But the courts there recognize the fact that enabling legislation dealing with parole and early release may create what they call a liberty interest, which are protected by due process guarantees. Now, it is our contention, Chairperson, that Section 79, as it currently, even in its current form, also creates such a liberty interest, because it gives a person an avenue of attaining some form of liberty. And in essence, then, we say that it does create a liberty interest. But what is less clear, Chairperson, is whether or not a prisoner has an enforceable right to be considered for medical parole. If you look at how the Act is phrased, the particular section, you say that any person serving is diagnosed and being in the final phase of any terminal disease or condition may be considered. And that is particularly problematic to us because it gives like a discretion to officials of the court, the correctional supervision and parole board, as well as the Commissioner of Correctional Services. That it's our submission, therefore, that it is undesirable to have a liberty interest provided by statute without a concomitant enforceable right to be considered to be released, to be considered for medical parole. Now, just in terms of other courts have dealt with medical parole in particular, the National Buildings Construction case in India, for instance, where they dealt with the issue of parole, where they say that basically a prisoner develops a legitimate expectation. Now, if I get sick in prison, I can develop an expectation that I might be released, because there's an act that says, there's a particular section that says, Section 79, that listen here, I may be considered for parole. It's customary as it is, but it creates that legitimate expectation at least to be considered. Now, the court in that particular case said that the mere existence of a reasonable or legitimate expectation of a citizen may not by itself be a distinct and forcible right, but the failure to consider and give due weight to it may render the decision arbitrary. And this is how the requirement of due consideration of a legitimate expectation forms part of the principle of non-arbitrariness, a necessary concomitant of the rule of law. Evidence of legitimate expectation is a relevant factor requiring due consideration in a fair decision-making process. Given that, and given the fact that our Constitution also allows us to have regard to international law and the laws of other jurisdictions, I think we should pay more attention to how other jurisdictions have dealt with issues pertaining to medical parole. So the Commission therefore appeals to this committee and the Department of Correctional Services that every application from a prisoner to be placed on medical parole be considered. And it must be considered fairly, objectively, and without a preconceived intention to reject them. And we also think that the principles of natural justice require this considerate approach. Now, a prisoner can have a negative report. Say, for instance, the medical practitioner saying, no, it's okay, man, this guy is fit enough, he doesn't need to be placed on medical parole. We must also bear in mind, and we should also probably inform a prisoner that he or she has a right to bring in his or her own medical practitioner to test him in accordance with the Section 35 rights of the Constitution. And just for the benefit of this committee, I will quote the relevant provision of Section 35, which deals with arrested, detained, and accused person. Subsection 2 thereof says that everyone who is detained, including every sentenced prisoner, has the right, and I go to subsection F, subsection 4 there, to communicate with and visited by that person chosen medical practitioner. So in for issues pertaining to medical parole, I think it is important and it's only the right thing of the Department of Correctional Services to let such a prisoner know of the existence of that particular right that he or she is entitled to bring in his or her own medical practitioner. Because the other problem is, and it's a problem in many other instances, especially in terms of mental illness, in terms of our judiciary, and the way the IAS of PEP people of our judiciary instance, this whole judicial deference to the expertise of medical experts, that is a doctor, can't lie, there's a report for all to see. I think we all are like that. You go to the doctor, you believe the man, even if you say like you're gout and you know you have a toothache. I mean, and so, we have to be careful about this. So that's why I think that it's a very, very important constitutional prerogative that, that we must, that prisoners or people that want to go on medical parole do have. Now, furthermore, in terms of just the due process kind of things and how we deal with medical parole, the rules and whatever, I want to also draw this committee's attention to the provision of Section 33 of our Constitution, right of Section 6 of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act 3 of 2000, which guarantees provide for administrative action that is lawful, reasonable, and procedurally fair. Like PASA sets out clearly what procedures must be followed for the administrative entity for, because the application for to be placed on medical parole is inherently an administrative aspect, so this is procedure. And so we need to have regard to Section 6 of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. Then also in this whole thing, when when a sick person applies for medical parole, now they, and like I'm moving on dangerous ground now, and please correct me if I'm
that's
wrong.
That's fine.
I think the procedure is different than what ordinary parole, in terms of the application and stuff like that. I don't know to what extent victims of crime should or are playing a role in this whole process. Now we know it leads to a lot of disquiet in our communities. When you see this person was sentenced last year and here's the man again, even if he's in a wheelchair outside his mother's door, it's like he looks very ill again. And there's a whole sense of the community, what's happening? These criminals are getting off lightly. Because they haven't been considered, they haven't been part of the decision-making process and whatever. So our community is setting for us, but also victims. And in terms of the victim charter, the right to offer information as set out in the victim charter, for a victim to go there and make input as to how he or she feels about that person. Now, the danger comes in there because it is a very, not technical, but a very scientific kind of determination. But if we say that we want to put victims central to the criminal justice process and not subsidiary to it, then I think some space must be open for victims of crime to have access to this procedure when a person applies for medical parole. And the community, of course, has an interest through the community safety forums, but that's a thing that we are still stressing out at this moment, I believe. And then just like a couple of conundrums in terms of conditions of release, what will the condition of release be of medical parole? And then I would like the committee to lead me and like some other expert because I couldn't, because like, you see, like, if you release someone on medical parole, if that person gets better, are you going to punish that person for getting better and send him back to prison? Or do you, because like, you can't take him voluntarily, you can't have compulsory testing. Say it's an HIV-AIDS case, and say his CD4 count dropped to below 200, below 200, it's 150, and he's terminally ill. He goes outside of prison, he takes his ARVs, his CD count drops up, the man gets better, blah, 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 blah. Are you going to now say, like, hey, there's compulsory testing for you, can't there be a condition of his parole? They can't compulsory test you, how does it interfere with his other rights, and blah, blah, blah. These are, I mean, like, questions that we really need to answer as well. And, like, it's a difficult question. And Honorable Chairperson, I'm not going to stand here and pretend to to know the answers to it. But it's something that I, for one, would really also like to look in, and like this contestation of rights, basically, and how we'll deal with it. I'm going to stop there, Commissioner. There's some stuff regarding OPCAT, the Optional Protocol Convention Against Torture, some considerations that we need to have there. There's some other considerations. Like, I mean, I even have a colleague yesterday told me, listen here, you must consider the Disability Convention, because a person that's terminal, you can't be considered to be a person that falls under the Disability Convention. I said, like, wow, I don't have time for that. I'll check it later stage, but I'm not going to go for comedy or the argument that I haven't researched right now. So, but in terms of the Human Rights Commission and our role, Chairperson, in conclusion, we do have an overarching mandate in terms of Section 184 of our Constitution to promote, protect, and to more than monitor rights. Now, we, as you know, like this House or this did a... when they reviewed all the Chapter 9 institutions, the Kader Asmal Commission, that they looked at Chapter 9. And one of the findings that they made was the lack of collaboration and cooperation between different Chapter 9 institutions. Now, although it did deal only with Chapter 9 institutions, I think the same is also true for the lack of cooperation between the Human Rights Commission and the different inspectors of prisons. I mean, like, there's so many ways in which we can complement each other. And I think that as a Human Rights Commission, I will raise it with my superiors and say, like, it's probably time, especially with regards to prison rights, that we probably take a more active position in some of the terminations of these rights to see, in terms of our overarching mandate, to secure the human rights of all South Africa's inhabitants. I just want to add that we would like to reiterate and we would like to highlight the emphasis that our Constitution places on human dignity. As with the right to life, human dignity also constitutes a non-derogable right. And more importantly, it is a right important enough to be considered as one of the core values of our Constitution and South African society by extension. As such, adherence to and promotion of human dignity must at all times trump any notion of vindictiveness or populism. Chairperson, we can become very populist if we want to be. Like I said at the beginning, and let me just come round circle and end there again, that given the high levels of crime and violence in our society, that society expects certain things from us. Society wants people to rot in jail. Society wants them to be killed and whatever. But popular accountability doesn't always accord with legal accountability. And it's incumbent upon us in building our Constitution that we must have regard to our legal accountability, but more important so, our moral accountability. And as such, we are very, very grateful that we could have made like a small contribution in that discussion. Yeah, Sam?
We still have an hour. Mr. Fante, for you to continue, because it was very, very, very much informative. But I'm going to give the members of the committee chance to ask questions. Lucas, that's fine. Okay. Everybody a chance to interrogate to ask questions for clarification. We are not here to interrogate Mr. Fanfei. No, we are here to ask questions for clarification. I personally have some direct and straight questions because his presentation is very direct and straightforward to the point. But members, let me open up for you. Mr. Fante, let me start because I can see that the members are still digesting. what you have said, because you were very energetic, very open. You have pointed out that the constitution of our country is very clear of the rights of people. Now medical parole, you have also made a call to the department and to this committee to say that when a person applies for medical parole, the department must take it serious and consider it. You have also said that, and it's in the constitution, that person is having right, the inmate, to have his own medical practitioner to make that assessment above the one of the state. But we are sitting with a situation, and you are South African. I'm not talking about with a Nigerian here. You are South African. We are sitting with a situation in the country, as you have said, crime is so high and whatever, where a medical practitioner, state or private, comes up with a report, then me as Dennis Bloom wants to criticize that report of a medical practitioner. How can we address that type of, you know, the mentality of people? You are so right that you have trained in a different skills of life. The same with me. I can't come up and say no. Dennis is not sick, or Paul is not sick. Let's leave it. You know, didn't Ms. Chikunga raised the issue last week with the department to say that it's not all people who die in prison of HIV and AIDS. There's other people with, she knows the term, I can't, failure and what is that? Cancer and failure of something and something and something. And we are not recognizing, you see, we are only concentrating on HIV and AIDS, and that's it in prison. When people are lying there and they are terminally ill, we think in our minds that terminally ill means that you are HIV AIDS positive and you are going. But when you are Colin Stanfield was diagnosed with cancer, other people are lying there with sugar diabetes, others are lying there with TB, others are lying there with other diseases. Cindy will quote this term. So I am saying that the human rights, I'm very much happy that you raised this thing to say that you are, that the commission is going to get direct involved in overseeing this type of thing. Because the human rights were very, very quiet on this. But that is my two questions, Mr. Van Zee. You know the two questions. The mindset of people questioning reports of I will do some other questions. I'm having a few here. Bishop Tolo then, and Cindy Chikunga then is up here. And then Mama.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chairperson. In the presentation of prove the image classification system to protect inmates who have committed lesser crimes from the more heartless and the dangerous criminals. You know, I came from rural area where we are still far away from know many things, you know. But I just find out your organization, because sometimes you find when somebody was being arrested, people, they say now the government they say people who commit a crime, can a criminal or less. But people, they say now, they say they've got a right more than us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question to you, your organization, you mobilize community also to talk to them about this issue. I'm not saying we're not talking, but we are also trying to talk to the community. But my just question, do your organization also go to all South Africa? Because some things you find, you know, I'm 60 years old at my age. I'm staying rural. I did not see even single day where Human Rights Commission comes to there to mobilize people to talk about this issue. Just in the TV, where you see in the TV. And in the TV sometimes, most of the time, just talking English, and most of our people, African people, most of us don't even understand. We are saying people that they're wrong and all those things. But we say only, if you can look at 2003, 2004 statistics, I mean the yearbook, the Zulu is 23%, Xhosa 13.3%, African 13%, 89%, English 8%. Which means just obtaining 8% of people in South Africa. But I don't think maybe we can say something that wrong, because they don't even know understand that, which means that English is a small language. They, according to me, when I'm looking there in the yearbook, it's the number Zulu, Xhosa, African, English, number 5. Now I just find out, because you go there also address the people about it, to understand this thing, because we are, it's a problem. When you talk as a politician, we are trying to see them. We are trying to see them. But some people, they say, no, we take you in parliament now, we are saying, what God is feeling about this? Those kind of things. But I'm trying to say, well, you do that kind of job to help our community. But don't think I'm criticizing, I'm not saying that. But the oldest languages is God who created this language. But sometimes you see, we compete with the God to say, this is a life that survives, or it's like that. And just make my mind. It's a commanding question. Thank you very much, Mr. Sean. Thank you. Whether this is
even with early treatment, even with TB treatment, to be cured. But there will come a stage where a doctor will say, you were late to get treatment, and there's nothing we can do at this stage. Your lungs are completely damaged. So you are going to die in the liver of a month or whatever. I sometimes think that it's just an excuse. It's possible to know. It's not like when a person says that HIV positive or becomes ill, therefore it means that person has reached a terminal stage. But it simply means that a person is ill. Then you need to investigate. Those investigations will lead you to making a correct diagnosis. That from this HIV positive person, this has happened, blood leukemia, or this person is not having meningitis, he is definitely going to die whether you give the treatment or you don't give treatment. He's going to die. Then the patient is going to die then, and that's what you can do. Even out. So I just wanted to emphasize this S, that it stands for syndrome, very key. It's just not a name of a disease. That is why doctors will not be able to say, to die from AIDS, because that is too quiet as a diagnosis. You must specify that you die from TB, because TB that is a lot as a result of your undermined immunity.
Thank you very much. After she's the specialist, then Bishop Tolo is the specialist in rural and theology. This is our health specialist. I'm introducing now the health specialist and rural affairs and theology. Yes. But can you please add to Mama?
Thank you, Chair. First and firstly, my apologies for coming late. I had to attend a public hearing on labor. I want to thank the meeting for a particular explanation and definition of the various how your diagnosis could be treated. My concern, Chairperson, is that as the explanation was given by our president, that a inmate has people their right to have their own medical practice, and then you've got your private, other side, your public and private practice. What happens if there is a conflicting diagnosis? What do we do? What steps do one take from there when there is difference of diagnosis, of difference of opinion of the person? What happens there and how? What step do you take from there? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mohan. Very good question. Mr. Pansay?
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with the last question, since it is right here. If you look at Section 79 in how it's phrased, it says that medical parole be considered by the commissioner, the parole board, the correctional supervision and the parole board, or the court. I think that in the case of conflicting diagnoses, that the court is probably the more appropriate forum to consider medical parole, unless we can have a supervisory board or commissioner that is totally our face with this kind of very scientific kind of report. But I think it's probably fair to assume that in an instance like that, we probably have to avail ourselves to the jurisdiction of the court in that matter. I don't know to what extent the parole board can make provisions to co-opt people with the necessary expertise. I'm not sure about that. But I think my hunch is that the court would be the appropriate forum to adjudicate such a dispute. Coming to Bishop Tolle, I accept Chris in what you say. Now, let me just say from the would go there. The commission is a lot more than the Bavis and the Malemas and the, these kind of things that make the news and whatever. We received like over 11,000 complaints in the last year, for instance. Most of these complaints we handled away from that thing, or those cameras. We have provincial offices in all 9 provinces. We are building the capacity of that office. It has been a challenge for us to build that capacity. We are addressing it to be there. We have education offices in all the programs. We go to schools, we go to churches, we go to this council. We get invited to such a lot of councils where we go there and do train people in human rights in the language of their choice. What we do is we have people in the commission and we are very, very sensitive about it in terms of our hiring practices to make sure that the language distribution is correct, that we have people that can speak in all languages. And when we go to particular communities, especially the airport, we have people, especially education officers, that can speak most languages or all the languages. So we have appropriate people that can go to communities and speak to communities at their particular level. In terms of the media as well, I mean, I also do Radio Sonder Grenzen, Afrikaans commentary, and then like, on some stuff. Like, I'm the official Afrikaans guy now at the Human Rights Commission. It's me and Commissioner Leon Dessel. We are the two Afrikaans guys. So, evidence. So we try. So we radio the series, calls, we make sure that there is a South Sotho speaker that speak on the radio, on the series, and so forth. Radio Barberton, we make sure that there's a Swati person that can speak on that particular community radio station. So we try our best. But like I said, like a lot of the stuff that we do as a commission happens away from the camera and is there. If you look, for instance, just in terms of arrested, detained, and accused person, like of the 11,000 complaints we received, 885 of those came from prison. Now, I didn't have time, but I also want to make an aggregation of just some medical parole, how many cases, or the work of our legal department, the out of medical parole in the discussion, and I can come back to this committee with that particular number of our cases the commission dealt with regarding to what we are talking about here today. But I would just like to say that in last day, this particular house, the General Assembly, Parliament, is the institution to whom we are accountable to. Ultimately. And every year we come here to Parliament and we present our report and say this is what we have done. And Parliament, being the representative of the people of South Africa, the duly elected representative, then they have the right to question us about what we have done and make a pronouncement on how they see we have fared. And I must say that all along we have been getting great reviews. And even the Kader Asman report was very generous about what it thinks of the commission, I mean, of the Chapter 9 institutions. I mean, I don't want to go into comparisons, but like, I think there is something that we do right. And we are okay. And we like I said, we can talk. I think I'm among friends here. That for the commission, and like, it that we probably also have gone through quite a challenging time. In the last thing, and like we are not immune to challenges that we are facing throughout our constitutional democracy. And after 14 years, you must ask question: is that still appropriate? Is that still appropriate? How do we build the commission? How do you see the role of the commission? Must the commission say, "Step we cannot remain static. We can't be rigid in our way that we have to develop what the constitutional says without compromising our core mandate, which is the promotion, protection, and the monitoring of human rights. Coming to your question, Honorable Chairperson, about our mindset, it's like, yeah, it is like that. It is almost disarming when you talk about medical issues, because it is unfamiliar terrain, and like I said, the thing is like, even our courts, it's like there's a lot of judicial deference, and just accepting that a medical report is true. I mean, if you look at corruption in the Workmen's Compensation Act, How many doctors fabricate stuff and people sitting in the Department of Labor and checking a report from a doctor? I mean, they just like me leave it. I mean, it's so easy to commit corruption in terms of the Workers' Compensation Act. They're like, okay, let's vote this guy. You go to a favorite doctor that's maybe a drinking buddy or whoever, and he's like, okay, I'm going to vote you. Whatever. And you just have like a toenail that's maybe ingrown or something, and he bought you, and like the person in the Department of Labor. That is the kind of the digital equivalent I'm speaking of. But like what medical parole and like the mindset, it's like, yeah, I think it is incumbent on every institution. If we want to apply fair administrative procedures, we must interrogate these reports, even if there's only one report in front of us, and just not accept it. But we have to interrogate it to the extent that we are capable. And we should not, for instance, be shy even to get assistance. I mean, you government is more fond of these consultants most, no? I don't know, maybe. So, but nonetheless, we need it, yeah. But yeah, our mindset.
But the disadvantages are fond of consultants.
Okay. But I say another correction.
Yeah.
But it is. I think you're right. It is a thing that, especially with issues of medical parole, because it's easy to defer, and then once you defer, you always become detached from the problem. And once you engage the issues properly, I think it's then we will be able to keep our eyes on the ball, because we're really engaging, even with medical reform. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, any other questions? Follow up.
The answer to my question was if there is a conflict of opinion between the two doctors, so the management takes the decision. Was that your answer?
I think so. I think the decision has to be taken. I mean, even like, how are we going to wait? I mean, like, I don't know. I've never been involved in a case where...
Let me I think the act is very clear when it... I think the act is very clear when it comes to conflicting statements. I mean, the commissioner, the national commissioner is there, then the minister is the political head who must intervene and take decisions on this. This is what the act is when it comes to that, when it comes to conflicting reports. Yes. Yes.
Just a minute. Is there any chance of a referral to a special? Should there be a conflicting opinion between two private
sectors? That's why I'm saying, it's part and parcel of the process of the commissioner and the minister. I don't think that they are also not medical practitioners, but they will call in some
expert
to help them.
Yeah. Sorry, can I just
quickly start here?
I think what the honourable member probably just highlights, I think one of the recommendations that came out of their annual report or the decision of the inspector of prisons surrounding the vagueness of Section 79 and like the real call, and like I would like to add our voice to the particular call for a serious review of that whole section. And without, because it's extremely vague. It's extremely vague.
Yes.
And I would like to add our voice to that particular call for a review of Section 79. Thanks.
Yeah, now the office of the inspecting judge will appear before us. What is the date? And they will have their chance to come and talk to us. But remember, yesterday, and I want the Human Rights Commission maybe to respond or give your opinion.
Yesterday, not yesterday, over the weekend I was approached by the Department of Correctional Services just to inform me that Mr. Sheikh is still in hospital after five months. They took him in March. He went to hospital in March. And I'm saying, if you are capable in responding, it's not, but I think it's also a human rights issue, the whole thing that I'm talking about. They raised the issue to say that he is there now for 5 months, and according to them, his condition is not getting better inside. The hospital. Now, you see, exactly, we are not doctors. And I personally, as Dennis Bloom, can't say they are not right and or they are wrong. Because I don't have, I said yesterday that I will ask the committee, consult with the committee to have a proper meeting where the department will come and brief us formally about this issue, so that we must know. It's only Cindy here, I'm very much sure, and many other people that is at least having what do you call it? Medical knowledge. But I am saying that. This is an issue before the committee now that we must apply our mind. You see, you have said, Mr. Fante, or Mr. Munti, we don't know when is when. You see, it's very important. We don't know when is when. Cindy has tried to answer it. Organ failure and whatever. Now, I think that this committee, and I will ask the committee to stay behind after the meeting, so that we must discuss this whole thing of the formal report and the formal briefing by the Department of Correctional Services to us, so that we can see and ask questions in that meeting. But maybe from your side, because I personally, I am very much concerned about when, you see, we are sitting with 1,249, and we don't know, even the office of the inspecting judge don't know what was the causes of those people dying. So I am saying that personally, as a human being, I'm concerned about such incidents. And not only on that's why we are talking about it, not only about Mr. Shafiq Sheikh, but all the people who sick and who is terminally ill. We must apply our minds and take it very seriously. We can't wait until a thing has happened and say that no, now we are jumping onto that thing. It will be too late. I'm saying that I will ask the committee to stay behind so that we must discuss this thing. But if you can have something.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, I was reading that particular comment of yours in the Star newspaper. On my way down from Johannesburg this morning,
yeah.
And I was thinking to myself that, wow, I hope this snake doesn't react ugly here today in this committee, but like, Anthony.
Yeah.
But like, I think like in terms of this question, from a human rights perspective, I would just want to say that we just have to keep adding to the principles of equality. And the equality clause in our constitution, and that we must make sure that we can satisfy ourselves that there is no differential treatment between prisoners. And I think that the provision of equality, which I must also add, is also one of the core values of our constitution, is adequately satisfied in dealing with this matter. Yeah. So yeah, I'll stop there. Thanks.
No, thank you very much for that. I mean, you have quoted now the constitution of the country. But let me thank you, Mr. Fante.